This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
And welcome to everyone who's new to Jikoji. Some of you had meditation instruction this morning, and maybe the first time you've meditated in this particular way. Other people have been meditating for a while. This really, as mentioned yesterday or last week, there's really no difference between this kind of beginning mind and the mind of someone who's been meditating for a long time. It's not just that everyone is equal in meditation. It's even more profound than that. Every time we meditate, we begin. Whether you're an expert, whether you've been meditating for 50 years, or whether you just started, everyone begins. And they begin with a kind of innocence, you could say. Innocence and curiosity. Sometimes when we think about coming to meditation, we kind of have an agenda. We think, oh, I want to be better, or I want to be peaceful, or I want to have a resolution to my problems, or I want to be a Buddha, want to be wise, or something like that. So we might have an idea that when we come to meditation, that we want something, we want to get something from it. And that's normal. We all have that in us. We can't discount that. That kind of acquisition mind exists in all of us. But this kind of innocence that we come to in meditation is really important. It's kind of like, the best way I can describe it is kind of an analogy. Say we haven't been to our hometown since we were very young, and we go back to our hometown and we know it's going to change. We know it's going to be different because we haven't visited our hometown for 20 years or whatever. And we come back to our hometown and we come back to it with curiosity, with interest, and with a kind of innocence, because we don't know what that hometown is going to be like. That's kind of what practice is like. Last week, we talked about the practice experience. Some of you may have been here. And we used the poem of Dogen Zenji about a boat that is half submerged. There's no wind, there's no waves, and the boat is half submerged in the middle of the night. And because it's still, because it's settled into the water, it's reflecting the moonlight. It's radiating moonlight. So we use that metaphor. And I thought today we could maybe continue with our discussion about the practice experience and kind of stay with that same metaphor. So I have another story to share with you from the Zen tradition in China. In the Tang Dynasty times, it was like the golden age of Chan or Zen in China. And there were many wonderful teachers and kind of a flourishing of this meditation practice in China at that time. And from that tradition came up these kind of anecdotal stories, these and they sound like conversations. Some of them sound like, you don't know what they're talking about. It sounds like a puzzle, you know. It's kind of a mystery, because sometimes the language is very has kind of literary associations that take place back in China, or sometimes they're just, you know, what they're talking about. But all of these stories, all of these conversations, usually between a teacher and a student, sometimes between two teachers, or sometimes just a teacher will make a statement, they became famous, and they became retold. They became public cases, and they were called kung'ans or koans. So this is a koan. This is a koan. This is case 51 from the, what's called the Shoyuroku, or the Book of Serenity, which is a collection of these compiled by a teacher named Huangzi. He's one of the great teachers in China. So this one, this case, we're going to use this as a kind of a lead off to talking about practice again. The teacher was named Fa Yan. And Fa Yan asked the elder Zhao, who had just arrived at Fa Yan's monastery. Fa Yan asked Zhao, did you come by boat or did you come by land? Simple question. Did you come by boat or did you come by land? And Zhao said, by boat. Fa Yan said, if that's so, where's the boat? And Zhao said, the boat is on the river. That's it. That's the story. That's the story. Take that home. there's a little aside too. So after Zhao had withdrawn, Fa Yan, this eminent teacher, turned and asked this monk who was an assistant standing right next to him. He said, you tell me, did monk just now have eyes or not? That's the story so far. Oh, there's an addition to this. there's an accompanying verse. And this might clarify things a little bit. So Huangzi says, water doesn't wash water. Gold isn't changed for gold. Find a horse without knowing its color. Enjoy the lute without the strings. Tie knots, drawing trigrams. When these are such things, completely lost is a true pure mind of the original person. So maybe that'll give us a gate in. So what does this teach us? This simple statement. Person comes to a monastery. The head of the monastery says, how'd you get here? He said, Did you come by boat? Or did you come by land? Fayan, the head of the monasteries, he said, and then he said by boat, and I just came by boat. And Fayan said, "If that's so, where's your boat?" And the person said, "I left it on the river. I didn't take it with me." How can this help our practice? Realistically, what are we doing? When you think about it, each of us has a life, a container, a vehicle, a boat. Each of us comes here with a self. And it's what we got. I mean, we spent how many years? I'm 80 right now, so I spent 80 years constructing this self. It's very familiar to me. I like it. It's me. It's embodied. I've got a lot of problems, a lot of issues. But it's the only show in town. It's me, I've come here with a me. All of you have come here with a me, a you. We've come here with our boats. This person arrived at the monastery and he left his boat on the river. So before he even came to meet his teacher, he actually dissolved or put aside or released, you could say, this sense of there's me and then there's the world. There's me in contrast to everything else that's not me. He released that division, that barrier, and he met the teacher. This is hard work because we've got a lot invested in this boat of ours, in this meanness of ours, of this self. And here we are. We've got our memories, we've got our history, we've got our name, we've got our relatives, we've got our identity. Without discounting that and still taking care of all that, can we meet the world? Can we meet another person without carrying around on our backs the boat of our identity? So this is kind of the challenge of meditation, because if we're really doing this, if we're really meditating thoroughly, there is a dropping off, there's a release, there is a this is a common term, there's a letting go. And also in that letting go, there is recovery. Recovery in the sense of recovering your true nature, your primal nature, which is not a nature of separateness. It's not a container. Because this life of ours, if we look at it realistically, not just not just with our minds, not with just with our conceptualness, but even with our bodies. If we look at it with our bodies and with our minds, we see that we are unavoidably interrelated and connected with everything else. I'm sorry, you can express your individuality all you want, your autonomy, your uniqueness, and that's all true. But along with that, you're unavoidably connected with everything else. In fact, you're dependent on everything that's not you. Everything that is not you, as I mentioned last week, actually defines you. It sounds weird, but think about it. I used the same thing last week. You have a container, right? Your consciousness, which is probably located in your head, is biologically located. It's located in your body, this bag of skin, and that's you. There you are. But how do you know you are you? Well, everything that is not you is defining you. Because without everything that's not you, even the atmosphere around you, there's no edges to you. There's not even edges to your body. So you can actually make the argument that everything that is not you defines you. And given that everything that is not you defines you or makes you you, how can you not acknowledge your interconnection with everything? How can you not enjoy the interrelationship of you in accord and in harmony and in absolute relationship with all beings and all things and all life? Nonetheless, we carry our boat up from the river, and we say, here I am, this is me, I'm separate from you. It's what we do. And the wonderful thing about meditation is it helps to dissolve that. It helps us to remember our interconnection and helps us to recover our primal interconnection with all beings and all things. Sometimes I think about this when I'm driving a car, because we don't go in boats very much, but everybody drives a car. And I'm driving a car on the highway, particularly on a interstate. Other cars are going by. Some are going faster, some are going slower. And here we are. We're all in our exoskeletons. Do you know the term? Exoskeletons. You know, like a bug that has a hard shell. We're all in our little hard shells, driving by. And we're all kind of separate, but we're all kind of connected on the highway too. And we're all kind of in tune with, if the driving's going well, unless there's a crazy driver, we're all kind of in tune with each other's driver, So in a certain sense, that's similar to this boat metaphor, that here we are, we're in our separate little cells, and yet in our exoskeletons of our separate selves, our clothes, our house, our car, still, in order to be in the world, whether we know it or not, we have to be in relationship. We have to be in tune with the world around us. I think it's You know, other metaphors could be made as well. I mean, there's like Jiro and Jackie work on the grounds at Jikoji, and they take care of the plants, and they make the whole environment around here very harmonious. And that simple activity of attending this thing, or like Jeff takes care of all the technology around Jikoji, you know? It's just a simple activity of like taking care of kind of something more than your exoskeleton. And maybe many of you in your work, and like Chuck takes care of a lot of the problems and fixes things around Jikoji. And I think many of you in your work or in your relationships, without thinking it's a big deal or abnormal or profound, are taking care of your world, and you're actually expressing a kind of interrelationship, a kind of connection. It just is happening, you know? You're kind of, yeah, I'm maybe I'm hauling my boat around, or maybe I have an exoskeleton of self, but still I'm connecting. Water doesn't wash water. Gold isn't changed for gold. Find a horse without knowing its color. That's from an old Chinese story. And enjoy the lute without the strings. Trying to own it, trying to own this or make it personal property, trying to employ it, was what he means when he says, tying knots, drawing trigrams, when there are such things, completely lost is the pure mind of the original person. So yes, we can practice this way. And in practicing this way, well, I think I mentioned in the meditation instruction this morning that that it's work, that it's definite work. And even the Buddha said this is against the current of human concerns, because the normal current of human concerns is acquisition, separation, property, ownership, and this is releasing, this is letting go, this is dropping off. So to go against the current, you know, to not obscure yourself, but to meet yourself in this meditation practice, it's work. It's definite work. And when you do this work, there's going to be upwellings, and there's going to be insights, and there's going to be trouble. So sometimes when people meditate, they find deep emotional upwellings come up. They make some space in meditation, and deep emotional upwellings come up. Sometimes in meditation, you find a kind of imperative to process some deep concerns. You also may notice habitual patterns that need to be released. So, with all this meditation, be forewarned. It is going to be work. There will be insights. There will be you will find a peaceful abiding within yourself. But it's not like it's handed to you. You yourself are the agent. You yourself are the boss. You're the driver of this. You have to steer. It's not like getting on a bus and someone is driving for you and you just sit and watch the world go by. That's not meditation. Meditation is you have to, it's your own vehicle. You have to get in there and you have to steer. And if you hit a curb, well, steer back, you know? And if you take a side road, which happens in meditation, believe me, I've taken many. If you take a, you know, if you see a big billboard and it says, movie time or something like that, and you steer off, you know, yeah, that happens. But keep driving and, you know, get back on the road and meet yourself. Oh, I have much more to share, more stories and everything. So. But maybe another day. Does anyone have any thoughts or like to add something? Have a question?
I think sometimes, at least from my own personal perspective, carrying your own boat gives you a better sense of control. Like you can control how you present to the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can move the boat around. There's just a lot of sense of control.
Mm-hmm.
However, when you leave that boat and you let the outside exoskeleton define you, whether it's the environment, other people, interactions, there's not control. And so, you know, how does one develop the confidence or the, like you say, you know, be comfortable with self, or this is you, you know, there's no other shows on the road, it's just you. How does one cultivate sort of that sense of,
yeah, I'm okay, and I can't leave the boat now. As I said, you know, this is definite hard work, and there's a certain I would say a certain willingness, in a willingness to meet yourself, to be real. You know? You have to actually intelligently acknowledge that behind that desire for control is a basic insecurity that you're not safe, that nothing is secure. And first, look at that, and look at that like a detective investigating, a problem, you know, or like a scientist, you know, in a laboratory. You know, look at that basic insecurity that wants to control the world, that wants to control oneself, that wants the security of a strict form or a rule or a label of identity. First, study, I mean, really study where that insecurity arises. You know? With many of us, it began in childhood, you know, or it began with difficult relationships that we had in the past. So first study that, you know, and investigate that thoroughly, you know? And then ask yourself, what do I need to control, or what do I need to control? And is control a kind of power over the weather, or an earthquake, or other people, or myself? Ask what I want to control. So investigate it at its source. I recommend doing that. Okay. And then from there, you know, you can have real insights. Okay.
Thank you.
Anything else? Yes.
I'm curious, or going back to the story with the man who comes to the monastery.
I'm sorry, could you speak up?
With the story with the man who comes to the monastery, I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on what is the teaching in him not having eyes at the end of the story that you read?
Yes.
Where the man, the kind of afterword where they talk about how he didn't have eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like there's a teaching in that, or what is the teaching?
I thought, you know, Fayan talked after the person had left, who came by boat. No, I thought he said to his attendant, he said, that's a really good answer. What do you think? I thought that's how I took it, you know, like, I think he said, this person really had insight, you know, and what do you think? Does he have eyes or not? Yeah. Mm. Yeah. What is that, how you saw it?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, somehow he was attuned to his surroundings.
Yeah. He was kind of applauding this answer. Yeah, yeah. That was a good answer. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a question about sort of like the destination or the end goal.
The what?
The end goal, like for practicing, like from practicing.
The end?
Like the end goal or the destination.
End goal?
Yeah.
End goal.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe give an example. So I understand letting go gives you freedom. And then I kind of feel like the freedom will help you understand your heart and follow your heart. But it leads to something. Like once you want to follow your heart, you might want to achieve something. It could be something bigger, like relieving pain of others, or doing something that you feel you want to do, like a personal mission. This practice a little bit like shall we more like resign from some sort of reality or some sort of craving? Or should we actually follow the heart to do those things? But if we want to do those things, like you do need some sort of resource, and sometimes you need to have some control or something. I'm not sure if I'm making it clear. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I understand your question. Yeah. Best to approach this practice without kind of an agenda. Do you know the word agenda? Yeah. So not to have an agenda, like as I mentioned before, I wanna be better. I wanna be peaceful. I wanna have a house in the suburbs. I want a lot of money. You know, to have ambitions like that. You know, I mean, it doesn't work. You know. I mean, it doesn't work in other fields as well. It definitely doesn't work in meditation to have that, what's called a gaining idea, you know? And I mentioned this last week as well. There's a famous Christian mystic named Meister Eckhart, and Meister Eckhart said that one of the biggest mistakes, you know, in meeting, in his case, or sort of being one with God, but in this instance, like being meeting our true nature, is to have a merchant's mind, a mind of, I do this and then I get something. I want to buy peaceful abiding. So I'm gonna sit in this boring meditation for a long time, and I'm gonna buy it. You know, that's called merchant's mind. To come to practice where the merchant's mind is. Well, you can try it. Good luck, but I'll guarantee you it won't work. You know, and a merchant's mind will only create more stress and more craving in you. You know, so better to come to this in with a kind of, like I've said, like you come to your hometown with a kind of innocence. You know, you don't know what your hometown's like. You know, you don't know. You just it's where you were born. Right? There you are. You're just curious about what's going on. So come to it with a sense of curiosity. With all this, you know, which is kind of a pure mind, we do have to acknowledge that within ourselves, we're organic beings, and we have a kind of biological imperative to survive, and we have to eat, we have to, there's a sense of providence, or a sense of like, we have to have a place to live or a job and stuff like that. And with all that comes that acquisition mind, that inquiring, that mind of the merchant. So bear in mind that it's a natural phenomenon. But in meditation, and in this inquiry, this deep request that we have to become real in this particular way, that we want to, if not drop that off, at least soften that sense of acquisition and just be with our body, be with our mind, be with whatever arises in our mind, and be a good host to it, and let it come and let it go. And be with our emotional states, feel them completely, and let them come and go. And be a good host, and be present, but not have a sense of owning it, you know, acquiring it. You know? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Curious. So for me, I come from a family that is very attached to the idea of separateness and like individuality, and the only interconnectedness that they're comfortable with is within like the blood family. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, like as I have individually felt the benefits of a broader interconnectedness, that can make them feel confused or more rigid and mm-hmm. uncomfortable mm-hmm. and resistant, I think, to that idea. And I'm curious if you have thoughts on navigating those conversations when they see a broader interconnectedness as a threat, maybe.
As a threat.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Good question. Yeah. Because it's endemic of Western culture, you know, since modernity, you know, it was reinforced by Kant and Nietzsche and all those people, you know, this sense of absolute individuality, the autonomy of the individual, you know, and it's very easy to feel affiliation with your family. It's really easy, you know. But then when you get to your, and really love them and care for them, whether you like them or not, they're still connected, right? Yeah. Yeah. But then you get to your first cousins, not so much, your aunts and uncles, and your second cousins, and then so on and so forth. The natural inclination to feel that bond, that sort of tribal bond or that familial bond is dissipates, you know. So you know, Jiro led us in the Xinxin Ming, you know, having no preferences, you know, it's really wonderful teaching. And it's to have this broad and spacious view of interconnection. By the way, you know, Westerners may feel this individuality, but what they lose that people that come from Asia have that doesn't exist in the West is they have a sense of connection in the past. They really acknowledge and take care of their ancestors, whereas we in the West, you know, we put a heavy stone on top of them, put them in the ground, put a heavy stone on top of them to keep them there, and we forget them. Really, that's what we do. Yeah, but in Asia, they have this continuity that goes backward. You know? It's very interesting difference. These cultural differences. Yeah, yeah. As far as your issue about dealing with their insecurity. Well, take care of them. Just take care of them as best you can, you know, because they're insecure. Yeah. I don't know. Bring them a flower. Bring them flowers. Yeah. Okay. I think our time is up. Is that right, Jerome? Anybody else have a thought? Uh-oh. This guy's dangerous.
You bring it on me.
Sorry.
So many thoughts. You brought up last week that word soliloquy, soliloquy, which means to talk to oneself. And I know one of the languages that I studied, it turns out, is the language of dreams. It isn't verbal, it's of images. What I've noticed is, and then in my work as a carpenter, I need to be able to, I was trained to be able to say the numbers out loud so that the guy that might be cutting it would know. So I repeat what I do. I find myself sometimes wondering, you know, especially solo means by myself, who is this person?
Who is this person?
Yeah, who am I talking to? Yeah. And it's almost, this is a, and so I'm curious about it. This is some of the thing, I suppose, rather than some knee-jerk judgment, which I might add is some of what you were talking about, the virtue of practicing, perhaps getting older, is to respond rather than to react. So what I've noticed is in this soliloquy, it's not poetry, it's prose, exclusively, as this is. So it's almost as if I say those words out loud when I work, and I impress myself
in it. You know, it's a, like it makes an indelible mark. And so this is somewhat in the meditation process, as you say, or in the there's a lot of turning, churning of other things and thoughts, but what's this dialogue?
I get what you, I get where you're going to, but to answer,
just go like this.
We do culturally, we do have this situation. I'm giving a talk right now, you know, and by the way, Zen is very proud of itself and famous for loving silence. And here I am talking, you know. And also we say, we have this saying, no words can reach it. This practice is beyond words. And yet here I am talking, you know. And there's a, besides me talking, there's a lot of literature. There's a lot of famous stories. I mean, we're, it's, anyway, beyond, you know, we're, the way we connect so much is so much with verbalization, with language. And that one of the interesting things we find when we meditate is that we're surprised that we have this internal dialogue. Oh my God, I'm talking to myself. Oh my God, I've got an internal chattering going on to myself. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Sometimes it's what's called verbal imputation, or it's cognitive imputation. So we're imputing, or we're inferring things by the language itself. And when we meditate, we are surprised, we're almost exasperated by how much internal dialogue we are, how much we talk to ourselves. And by the way, if you do a meditation intensive, like if you meditate, like we have intensives that where we meditate all day for like 7 days, it's really hard to do. But if you do it, you'll find your internal dialogue actually drops off, and you actually stop talking to yourself. You actually get so bored with your internal dialogue, you stop it. Yeah. And it's a relief. And the more you stop talking to yourself in your head, the better you can receive the world. The better the world will come to you. And it'll come to you without words, without descriptions, without labeling, and particularly without assessment. There won't be that measurer inside you that's saying, this is good, that's bad. I like this, I don't like this. This is good for me. You'll just receive the world. So, that's our life, you know. We're bound by language, you know. Some of you are bilingual, but maybe you have two languages going on inside your head. I don't know. I only have one, but anyway. It's an interesting way that we meet the world. And you could say that the language itself is kind of like another boat. You know? So can we leave that boat at the river too? So. Anyway, I think that's enough. Let's adjourn up to the... We'll go up and have some tea and cookies. Are there cookies up there? Really? There's cookies? Cookies? Okay. Okay. So, we're gonna end with a chant.
Okay, let's do it again.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.